Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, which is heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, Salt Lake County tries to find a spot for the shelter it's on the hook for. Also, Salt Lake County Sheriff Jim Winder floats some radical proposals to deal with homelessness in the Rio Grande neighborhood. Plus, Orrin Hatch says he'll step aside if Mitt Romney wants his Senate seat, even as Salt Lake County Councilwoman Jenny Wilson considers her own run. Those and other stories on the docket today. And joining me in the studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Thanks for being here.
No problem.
Government reporter Christopher Smart. Good morning, Chris. Welcome
to you. Good morning.
Tribune columnist George Pyle. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
And on the phone, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning, Roger.
We encourage you to join the conversation during this Friday morning news wrap-up by posting your questions and comments at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Just quickly before we jump into the meat of the show, because I've got a captive audience here, a reminder to our listeners that here at KCPW, we are in our spring pledge drive. It's the final day, and we've got a lot of fundraising ground to make up. Visit kcpw.org to contribute and do your part for this public radio outlet. Thank you. All right, Thomas Burr, I know we've got you just for a little while, so I want to begin with you today and a story that came out this week that has to do with some polling that the Tribune conducted here in Utah. Despite pretty dismal approval ratings nationally, a majority of Utah residents now view President Donald Trump favorably. Tell us about this poll, Tommy.
Yeah, so we polled in January asking Utahns, what did you think of President Trump right before he took office? And it was essentially not as good as it is now, which is interesting. So just before he took office, 46% of Utahns viewed him favorably and 52% unfavorably. That's pretty shocking in a deep red state to have a Republican incoming president with less than a majority of residents. But that has flipped in the couple months that he's been in office, the 5 weeks he's been in office. And then you could probably attribute some of that to a little bit of a honeymoon period, that the president came in, he starts doing some of the things he said he was going to do during the campaign, even if he didn't succeed in getting some of them done. Utahns at least see the effort. And there's also a, you know, I think in Utah there's a little bit of let's give him a chance kind of attitude.
Yeah, and you you spoke with State Republican Party Chair James Evans on this. He's a Trump supporter. I think obviously he's a representative of his party, but has been historically too. He says that this is about Trump delivering on promises. Some of those promises, though, weren't exactly popular here in Utah during the campaign. Honeymoon period, but I don't know. There seems to be a little bit of a discrepancy there. Am I right about that?
Yeah, but there's things that people can look at. So maybe Utahns aren't exactly excited about the ban on 767, whatever it is, majority Muslim sure. Countries and immigrants and tribe visitors from those countries coming here. But they may have liked you know, the fact he came in and, you know, said we're going to drain the swamp and we're going to get some of this stuff done. And now the question is, can he get it done? But Utahns are kind of giving him like, okay, we'll wait a little bit. I will say that James Evans was very excited when I called him about the poll and thanked me for letting him crow for a little bit.
Okay, an opportunity. Some other interesting stats from this, and maybe not unsurprisingly, are that women view Trump less favorably than men in this poll.
No, and I think we find that nationally as well, that usually Trump supporters have been white men, and that continues to be the case in Utah, with men definitely giving Trump more of a chance. Women still very hesitant, but, you know, are waiting to see, I guess, in many ways. And, of course, the split along party lines is just what you expect it to be. I mean, Democrats seriously do not like the president. Republicans like the president. Independents are kind of in the middle ground, not sure what yet to think.
You know, despite the bump and the, you know, the honeymoon or whatever it is, the president still doesn't have the kind of ratings that most first-term Republicans have had here in Utah. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you'd look at this in any situation and say, had this been George W. Bush, the numbers would be 20 points higher. Had this been a Mitt Romney, they'd be, you know, 900% higher. but, you know, I can say this. I think this is a pretty much fact. My guess, though, would be that if Hillary Clinton were president, her poll numbers would be much, much worse in Utah.
You know, I'm thinking about the executive actions on immigrants and refugees that you mentioned. Those haven't necessarily been received well here in Utah, as they have as maybe they have in other places. And the Mormon Church may have a bit to do with that, with its global ties. It's been welcoming to refugees fleeing persecution elsewhere. And does that, I don't know, does that make the increase even more surprising here in Utah that there's a bump for approval by the president?
So our poll showed Utahns are pretty much split on that issue, on the quote-unquote Muslim ban.
Okay.
About 50% say they favor it, 48% against it. But part of that has to look at, you don't have to go too far back for most Utahns to know that one of their ancestors was an immigrant themselves. And in fact, Mormons were immigrants when they settled here in the Salt Lake Valley, because they, technically moved into Mexican territory at the time. So there's a bit of a concern about that, but I think you've got Utahns who are looking at other things. They do want health care reform. They do want tax reform. They do want to deal with immigration in some form. They want to get rid of the revolving door in Washington. So this is a hopeful poll. I'd like to see a year from now where these numbers stand.
Where it stands. A reminder to listeners that you are invited to join this conversation. Call us at 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. Columnist George Pyle, your take on this. During the election, Trump himself said that he had, just going back to the question of Mormon support for Trump, he said that he had a Mormon problem. Is that problem diminished now?
Well, I think it's going to continue to dog him as it goes along. I mean, his ratings here are higher than they are elsewhere. They're still not very good. And it is, I think, as Tommy says, a honeymoon. Let's give him a chance. Let's see what he does. Even though, while the church is very welcoming of refugees, there are a lot of white males all across the country who are very worried about that. He also had, I think this may have been after the poll was taken, but he also had the executive order about opening up coal mining again. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people in Utah who still cling to the idea that we're going to get those jobs back and we're going to sell the coal to China. I think as that goes along and we find out that those jobs are not coming back and we are not going to sell the coal to China, then that may not resonate as positively as it is right now.
Tommy Burr, I want to actually turn to you on that, because Utah's political leaders, at least, are probably pleased with that part of the president's actions, that he's rolling back President Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan. And this is something that state leaders had objected to and were even suing to prevent from happening. What's happening there?
Yeah, absolutely. And that the Trump's executive orders will be subject to somewhat of a court action there, too, because mm-hmm. that there's a lawsuit ongoing there. So the president came in and he said, essentially reversed Obama's efforts to combat climate change. Part of those efforts included a moratorium on new leasing for coal mines mm-hmm. On federal lands, and also changes to, some of the regulations on coal production and energy production and carbon emissions. And yes, this has Republicans, conservatives in Utah, rural Utahns, pretty excited, as you might guess. But the question is whether what it will turn into. Look, I'm from coal country. I'm from a small town in the middle of Utah that is, a huge driver of the economy there is the coal mine.
Right.
And they're excited about it. The question is, coal mining jobs have been decreasing for years and years and years, and it's not necessarily because of they don't have access to more coal. It's because natural gas is cheaper, and people are looking into wind and solar, and coal isn't just not the same. It's not the same as it used to be.
Okay, so it's not. I mean, the decline in coal mining isn't exactly the result of presidential guidance, but of economic factors.
There are a lot of other factors in this situation, and as Trump says he's the art of the deal and he's, he can fix everything. But that's one thing that's really hard to fix, because that's not something he has the power to do.
To intercede on. You mentioned state leaders. This is welcome news for state leaders, among them Senator Orrin Hatch, who said that the Obama plan was part of a radical climate agenda.
Yes. Yes, he did. He was very excited about what President Trump is doing. He feels like Obama did before was to destroy hundreds of thousands of jobs and hike utility costs for the consumers across America, and that Trump's going to change that. The question is, in some ways, this could bring back some jobs in different sectors, and this could, in fact, lower some utility rates because now power companies won't have to put, you know, these big scrubbers on some of the coal plants. But it's a trade-off, and it may be minimal in some ways, too.
And, of course, people who are concerned with the effects of climate change, both here in Utah and around the globe, they had a different response to this announcement from the Trump administration.
Absolutely. There's a big concern that that after all the efforts for, you know, years and years, they've been pushing to get some of this stuff done, and we finally got on the right track, according to them. What Trump does is put a, you know, big stop sign and could lead to later on, you know, coastal erosion, flooding, more horrible weather, and they're very concerned. I think one person I quoted talked about this as, like, you know, next to nuclear war, this is the worst thing he could do.
George Pyle, from your opinion chair, again, just going back to you on this issue, not exactly an unexpected action from the president, and a president who has consistently questioned the science, the clear science on climate change. I guess who stands to benefit from this, and how long will that last? We talked about there not being the economics behind these jobs necessarily.
Well, I think, you know, the only person that I can see who benefits from this is the president. He gets positive publicity in that area of the media where they do think that global climate change is a Chinese hoax, and they think that it was just horrible that they're taking the jobs away from all these coal miners. And Trump has a media availability, and he's standing around there with, you know, guys in hard hats, coal mining equipment, and saying, guys, you're all going back to work. And later on, most of them are going to find that, no, they're not going back to work. And as we've said, it's more the marketplace than it is any set of federal regulations that are going to make a difference in this. And then now we're all kind of looking around, and people who care about this thing are saying, well, maybe the federal government is just kind of lost on this for the next 4 years. California is going to step up. The European Union is going to step up. You know, they're making noises in California like maybe they want to have a Brexit where they're going to go make their own country. And at least, and Jerry Brown's talking about, well, we'll launch our own damn satellite if the NASA won't monitor climate changes anymore. But now, I mean, we're talking about the polls here. Nationally, Donald Trump is at 36% approval, which is like a record low. Obama never got that low. Reagan never got that low. And they certainly didn't get that low this early in their administration.
Right. Well, you know, I'm thinking about the science aspect of this and the climate change. There's a planned march on Washington. Scientists are planning a march on Washington on April 22nd, and we'll see what kind of an effect that has. Thomas Burr, I know we've got to let you go pretty soon here, so I want to turn to a kind of cluster of stories that you covered this week related to Senator Orrin Hatch. Actually, Matt Canham covered some of this as well. An interesting story. Hatch suggested he might step aside, meaning he might not run again. And Matt, maybe I'll turn to you on this. If Mitt Romney were to try to run for his seat, a kind of handoff here.
Yes, Orrin Hatch participated in an interview with the National Journal, and he was asked about whether he would run again in 2018 for an eighth term. He's already the longest-serving Republican, so this would be at the end of his term, he'd be there for 42 years. This would be six more tacked onto that, and he talked about how he's looking at it, but that he would be inclined to not run again if an outstanding person ran for that position. The reporter asked him if he had someone in mind, and of course he said former Massachusetts governor, current now living in Utah, Mitt Romney.
Okay, there, of course, are other potential GOP contenders for that seat, John Huntsman Jr., Evan McMullen, maybe even Jason Chaffetz, just to name a few. Did Hatch say anything about whether he would step aside for any of them? Was he asked about that?
He was asked about Evan McMullen and John Huntsman, and he immediately pivoted to say that he might run again, and if he did, he would win. So he does not consider Evan McMullen or John Huntsman in the same category as Mitt Romney.
Tommy or Matt, is this something that Mitt Romney might want to do, run for Senate? Matt.
You know, it's interesting. In a story like this, you would think that there would be a pushback if the answer was no. And when I talked with Orrin Hatch's staff the following day after the story appeared, they weren't trying to pull it back either. So it wasn't like Mitt Romney was calling him and saying, Orrin, you made a mistake in an interview. I don't want people to know about this. Tell him I don't want to do it. He didn't respond to comments, but he didn't try to stop the story either. When you cover politics, sometimes you're trying to read tea leaves. And if you're reading tea leaves in this circumstance, I think you can assume that the answer is a maybe.
A maybe. You know, there's another aspect to this, and Tommy, I'll turn to you for this one. We've heard tell of a potential Democratic contender for that seat, the Senate seat that Senator Orrin Hatch holds, someone who's kind of testing the waters right now. Who are we talking about here?
So Jenny Wilton is a Sully County councilwoman. She's currently serving the second six-year term on the council. I think she was off the council for a while. She ran for Salt Lake City mayor for a bit. She is not as well-known, obviously, as a John Huntsman, or certainly not as much as a Mitt Romney. But when it comes to Democrats, next to, you know, Bennett McAdams, she might be one of the more well-known Utah Democrats. And she has started an exploratory committee, which means that she can start, you know, raising money and looking at the idea of running for the Senate. You know, any Democrat in Utah in a statewide office faces a very uphill climb.
Right.
But Jenny also already... right now, she represents, what, 1.1 million people in the county because she's in an at-large seat. So she already represents a little more than a third of Utahns as it is right now. They probably know who she is. So that's a good starting point.
Okay, a place to begin with. Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief. I'm going to go to George Pyle for some comment on this and let you get to where you need to be. But thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Roger.
You're welcome. George, Salt Lake County Councilwoman Jenny Wilson, a Democrat. As Tommy said, Democrats haven't been having the best showing. Some see a bit of a fractured party as well. Not that the Republicans aren't suffering that kind of fracture as well, but could this race actually be competitive? Is this something that's possible?
Well, I mean, never say never, but the Democrats have such a poor showing in any statewide or congressional district race that it's almost kind of sad to see that somebody, Jenny Wilson's resume, might even want to try this because it just seems so impossible. And part of the problem, though, in our editorial about this morning was on this subject, is that Orrin Hatch seems to continue to believe that this seat belongs to him, and that if by some noblesse oblige he decides that maybe he is going to hang it up, it's his right to decide who gets it next.
There was a Tribune editorial on this.
And, yeah, like it's his to give, like it's his to will to his heirs. And part of the problem with that is, other than just the arrogance of it, is the way politics works. You kind of, if you're going to throw your hat into the ring, it really helps to know who it is you're running against. And if we knew now that Hatch wasn't going to run, then it would completely change the situation. More people would be interested. More people would start raising money. More people would start lining up county chairmen. But if you think, well, Hatch is going to run again, or if it's not Hatch, it's going to be Mitt, then other people out there, Republicans and Democrats, are more likely to say, no, what's the use? There's no chance. I can't raise any money. I can't get any traction. And it just completely closes it off. It's already the beginning of 2017. The real decision probably will be made not in November of 2018, but in the convention caucus system.
Sure.
That's in the summer. And so there's not much time left. And I mean, I would think Hatch really would owe it to the people of Utah, the voters of Utah, and his Republican Party to tell us pretty soon, yes, I'm running, everybody go home, or no, I'm not. Everybody, power up.
A firm answer is what George Pyle is looking for there in the Senate race for Orrin Hatch's seat. Listeners, we need to turn to other stories, but first we've got to take a quick break and take a couple of messages. But you are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, also across the state on Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Thanks for being with us. We're Behind the Headlines here on Utah Public Radio's The Spring Pledge Drive, last day of the drive, and in fact, we're counting down. The goal for today is opposite from the goal usually we're counting up. Today we're counting down to meet our overall goal, and we're just $1,600 away, $1,600 away from meeting our goal. So your pledge right now will help us to get very close to our goal, and we hope to reach that very soon. It's been a great drive. Thank you so much. If you have not taken care of your membership, now's a great time to do so to help us to hit that goal. 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. Toll free, or you can go to upr.org. That's upr.org, and we're counting down. We're very close. We're only $1,600 away. Your pledge right now can help us get there. 800-826-1495.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, government reporter Christopher Smart, and columnist George Pyle. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-8255 or commenting at sltrib.com. Chris Smart, we are waiting today, I think, to find out the site that Salt Lake County has chosen. We'll find out today, I think, for the homeless shelter that they are on the hook to build. Remind us the locations that are in the running right now, where we stand on this, that is, because there was a list that was a bit larger until just a couple of days ago, and we'll get to that part. But what's the news on where this shelter might go?
Well, there are nine potential locations. Some in South Salt Lake, some in West Valley, and two in Draper. So how we got here is kind of crazy. The process has been horribly flawed. And this all comes about because Salt Lake City had chosen a site in Sugar House. And people went crazy. They went to the legislature. And then it ended up that the county would take one of the three sites. And so then a selection committee went out and kind of looked around and decided on which sites might be palatable. And today's the day. And so we're unsure. I mean, it could be any place.
It could be Matt Cannon.
Actually, we know the place.
Oh, we do. Breaking news. Okay, we got to break some news on Behind the Headlines. Yes. Go ahead.
Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams is recommending location E at 3380 South, 10th West.
This is South Salt Lake.
This is South Salt Lake. It is near the Jordan River. It's on land that's now a nonprofit, so he thinks that will not hurt South Salt Lake as much because it's not taking land currently being taxed. He is promising that if this goes forward, that he'll try to get a county library and transportation projects to help mitigate the effects in South Salt Lake, but that is his recommendation.
And, you know, this is something that South Salt Lake, just to get into, they have not been, both South Salt Lake, almost every location that
every
we've gone
city
to
doesn't want
has
this.
Said, we don't want this.
The only thing that was different is that Draper, one day this week, the mayor said, here are two potential locations. I feel in my heart that it's the right Christian thing to do. And these locations were on the east side of I-15, or one was where the prison currently is.
Right.
There was a huge town hall the next day.
And he got shouted down.
By about 1,000 people, and he decided that he no longer felt in his heart that that was the right thing to do and tried to pull them back. And apparently Ben McAdams thought that there were better locations elsewhere.
Options, as it was anywhere. You know, do I understand right that a homeless man in attendance at this town hall was booed? I mean, he got booed by the audience?
Yeah, that's right. I think when people think about homelessness, they think about Rio Grande Street downtown, where you have about 1,100 people in the shelter, you have 500 people camping out around there, and then you have various and sundry folks just coming and going, some of whom are drug dealers. The place is lawless, it's chaotic.
This is the image people have.
This is what it's like on Rio Grande Street, and that's the image they have of homelessness.
Right.
But if they were to visit the Midvale shelter, which has 300 people, it's a family shelter, you would find none of that. There's a playground there. The only people on the playground are the kids and their moms. It has no impact on the surrounding area.
Salt Lake Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics also asked in our most recent poll if our respondents knew a person who was homeless or had been homeless in the past 2 years. Because when you know someone who's in a situation, you probably have a more nuanced view of it. And our respondents, 79% said they did not know anyone who had recently been homeless. 20% said they did. And not surprisingly, people in a higher income bracket did not know homeless people. It was, you know, poor people had a better chance.
Right.
And I think that might have played part of this, because what we've heard in every city is the concern about homeowners and their property values.
Well, you fear what you don't know. George Pyle, I want to bring you in on this. Draper, Sugar House, South Salt Lake, West Valley, all saying we don't want this thing. Of course, now South Salt Lake may be kind of forced to take it because this is the decision that Mayor McAdams has made. But we don't appear to be showing our humanitarian side here.
No, I mean, the riot in Draper the other day where they were booing the homeless guy who stood up on stage or stood up and said, you know, have some compassion here. We're trying to solve this. You know, that's getting picked up all over as an example of, oh, we thought you were nice Christian people out there in Utah. This is you know, whatever you've done to the least of these, you know, kicked them in the river. And but I mean, again, you know, the image of the truth of the Rio Grande neighborhood really weighs on people. Years ago, they formed this Pioneer Park Coalition, which was some business owners and developers who had an interest in that area. And I get kind of cynical about it, and I say this is like, you know, discovering gold in North Dakota, and you shoo away the Indians that you let live there because you thought the land was worthless. Now you find out there's gold there, so you make them move to Oklahoma or something. You know, they found out this land over there was ripe for development as the next downtown, but all these pesky homeless people in the way, so we have to do something about it. You know, over the years, we hadn't done anything about it. We left it to the road home, and they were pedaling as fast as they could just to keep people from freezing and starving. And they did turn some lives around, but not enough to make a visual difference.
Well, there's also the impact of the recession and other. Go ahead, Chris Smart, to cut you off.
Yeah, exactly. Beginning in 2008, this situation got much worse. And the median down has not recovered very well from that Great Recession. And so low wages, high rents, more people homeless. And what we've seen in the past 3 years, maybe longer, down in that area is that there have been more campers. The drug epidemic is in high gear. Folks who fell off the bottom rung of the socioeconomic bracket then turn to drugs to alleviate their crisis, their pain. And so it really has gotten worse in the last 3 years, according to just about everybody. That said, George is absolutely right. Pioneer Park Coalition wants, you know, they want to build down there. And that said, the residents and the business owners are really fed up because they have to put up with a situation where there are campers with no sanitation facilities, and it just goes on and on.
You know, go ahead, George.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, even they, and some of them were ready to put up serious bucks behind this, even they were saying, we want to move this, but we know nobody anywhere wants us to pick up the road home as it exists and plop it down in another neighborhood, even an industrial neighborhood, even, you know, plowed ground. Nobody wants that. We're going to have a different approach. And that's what they're promising us with these. They don't even want to call them homeless shelters. They want to call them homeless resource centers,
right?
Because the idea is instead just kind of holding your finger in the dike and making sure these people don't freeze to death. You're actually going to have caseworkers. You're going to have mental health. You're going to do all these things to turn their lives around so they come in, get helped, move on back up that ladder. If they can do that, then it probably doesn't matter very much where these are. If they fail, which is what everybody is worried about, then it just becomes another crime magnet.
Then it does matter. You know, another part of this is the associated services. I mean, talking just about the road home, but that are near the shelter, the St. Vincent de Paul Kitchen, Wiegand Homeless Resource Center, both of which are operated by Catholic Community Services. They're owned by the Catholic Diocese. Matt Canham, I'll bring you in on this and just turn to this story for a moment. And there are other conversations about homelessness that I want to have too, but the Tribune reported on some emails that it obtained pertaining to the conversation around homelessness at the county level. And one thing that emerged from those emails was reticence, both from the county and the owner of the Rio Grande shelter, to close that shelter on a specified date, and then also some conversation having to do with these associated services on Rio Grande Street. Tell us about this story. It's kind of complicated.
Yes. One of our reporters asked for all of Ben McAdams' emails from a certain period of time that involved homelessness. And what we found is an ongoing conversation within the county that at least touched on conversations that have happened with the state and other stakeholders that, you know, as we talked about, there are business interests who want to develop that area. Well, if you move the shelter, that's one thing. But there's a day center for where homeless people can interact during the day. There's a kitchen where they can get food. There's a health clinic. There's the 4th Street Clinic down there. And we've previously written that the shelter might close, but these services would stay. Well, apparently there's a behind-the-scenes move to force Catholic Community Services to close those facilities, and they had not actually told Catholic Community Services. There's warnings in these emails saying, like, you know, when this gets known, people are going to be upset. We need to start telling people. We reported that, and we asked the Catholic Community Services if they've heard anything about this. And the response from the spokeswoman there was not a whisper.
And meanwhile, the owner of the Road Home, and I can't think of the name now, but Shelter the Homeless, says that that both they and the county, or maybe it's the county who says this, the county will not move unless will not move this thing unless there actually are beds, the beds needed available elsewhere.
And right. It's a very – I mean, this is – like everything about this, it's more complicated than it maybe should be, and Chris probably knows this better than I would, that the group Shelter the Homeless is a board that has Ben McAdams on it. It has Scott Anderson from Zions Bank on it, but it also has developers down there in the area on it. And so it's a lot of competing interests that run this organization. And Ben McAdams has said that he does not want to see that close unless there is enough overflow beds elsewhere. And so there's talk of the state building another shelter at a place we haven't even started talking about for an overflow shelter somewhere in the county.
But we keep hearing pushback that there will be a date certain where that is closed. And so it's hard to know who's winning that fight. But I think the reality is if you don't have the new ones built and you close that one day, then what happens to those folks? And that's something that people don't really want to push up against. I mean, Jackie Biskupski wants it closed. The Pioneer Park Coalition wants it closed. So we'll just have to see.
Well, right now, of course, the close date, there is a firm, you know, supposedly firm close date of the end of June 2019. And we'll see what happens there. Again, economic interests at play on the sort of Salt Lake Monopoly Board here. Chris Smart, you know, we're talking about rolling out a new tack on homelessness with these resource centers. Some of that effort stems from a desire to spread the work around and literally geographically spread it around. It's the dispersed site model. In the meantime, Salt Lake County Sheriff Jim Winder has a draft, a 21-point plan to try to deal with homelessness in the city's downtown. The plan includes creating a kind of tent city. Tell us about this, Christopher Smart.
Well, so earlier this week, the Pioneer Park Coalition put out a release. Well, it actually was sent to its members saying how wonderful this plan was that no one had seen up till that time, and then they released the 21-point plan. And so it has a lot of things in it, but most notably, it would reduce to 200 the population of the Road Home by June 1st of this year. That's 2 months away. The population now, it varies. It's a maximum of 1,100. As the temperature gets warmer, it drops a little bit. Right. But so that's astonishing. Where are we going to put those 900 people right now? The sheriff says that they can go to a new campground that he's proposing on 1st South and 600 West. And that campground would be sort of a controlled area rather than the uncontrolled camping we see on 500 West now, but it wouldn't allow drugs, alcohol, or pets. Well, If you
why would you go there? I guess
That's why many of the campers use drugs and alcohol and have pets. So it's seems to have come out of the blue. But what the sheriff is saying is that situation down there is in crisis. I think that's probably a good way to put it.
Yeah.
He lists all of these things from, you know, sanitation on that are going down, and just sort of the danger and the the upheaval and just the mess. And he says, we've had committees and we've done this and we've done that. It's time to stop this. It's time to get serious.
Take some action. And an effort also, part of this plan is an effort to drastically limit the number of people who are using the road home shelter. And really quickly, explain that.
Well, he wants to reduce the population to 200, and he says that that's sort of the size of the what the new planned shelters would be. And he says he understands that people see that as being draconian, but he says, look, either provide services for all of those people or reduce the population to the point where you can provide services to everyone there. And then the idea, and then so he says people are going to say, well, you're just dispersing this problem. And he said, yeah, well, you know, you got to start somewhere.
Some split reaction to this plan. First off, just kind of, I actually have to go back to that point for a second, because our service, he's, the claim that's implicit in what you just said is that services aren't being provided to these people.
I think that the folks who want services can get them. The problem is when you become homeless, you kind of don't know where to go and what to do, and you sort of have to find your way. There are folks who are camping out down there who are unaware of services. They don't have cell phones. They don't have laptops. And so it's all a word of mouth. Ben McAdams says his new paradigm, his new strategy, will fix that so that people, wherever they go, they'll have an intake coordinator who puts them on the right track. But so we know that services are stretched, and we know that, but we do know that people can get them if they wait long
enough.
I just
wonder what problem reducing the shelter size to 200 would solve is sort of the question that I have. And we should mention the breaking news that came out again that Mayor McAdams is recommending Site E, which is at 3380 South, 100 West for in South Salt Lake.
10th West.
Sorry, for the new shelter site.
Somebody just had a heart attack.
Right. Somebody who's listening right now. Good point. Well, actually, let's get back to the split reaction on Sheriff Winder's plan, because there are a couple of groups that are involved in this. One is the Pioneer Park Coalition, not involved, but reacting to this, and although they were involved, as you pointed out. And then also the Downtown Alliance. I'm going to quickly note, just for full disclosure, that Downtown Alliance Executive Director Jason Mathis is a volunteer host here at KCPW on the program Downtown SLC. But somewhat differing reactions from the Pioneer Park Coalition and the Downtown Alliance, Chris.
Well, the Pioneer Park Coalition loves this. The Downtown Alliance is skeptical. They're of reducing the shelter population overnight and setting up a campground. So Winder's been talking about this, he says, for 2 years. He's talked to these business groups. He's talked to others. The Pioneer Park Coalition, according to Winder, said, look, why don't you write this down? And so he did. And then he wrote it down and presented it to them and the Downtown Alliance. The Pioneer Park Coalition ran it up the flagpole, said, this is great. The Downtown Alliance, not so much, but it hasn't. It wasn't the type of thing that we see going through the usual process of meetings. And that's one thing the sheriff says. Look, you guys have been meeting for decades, and look, it's a worse mess than ever. It's time to just do something.
George Pyle, you know, we talked about Draper and planned development out there at the site of the old state prison. As I look at the Pioneer Park area, long-term plans for development in that neighborhood as well, maybe a common denominator there. I'm myself not a property owner, and so maybe it's easier for me to say this, but isn't it kind of uncomfortable, slimy even, to pit the people among us who are most struggling against the concepts of against that concept of economic development and property
values? Well, it has ever been thus, and we're having a problem here because, they're building apartments out there like dandelions, and still people can't afford to get in them unless the city has taken a special step to make affordable, or now what they're calling deeply affordable, which means affordable, places to live. And they're, you know, and part of what they're doing is sometimes they're tearing down old single occupancy buildings that, you know, maybe you could afford to squeeze in. The sheriff's plan and some of these other things are like Chris says, do something. And he just kind of throws this bomb out there. And all the people who say, well, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. And then his answer and the Pioneer Park Coalition's answer is, well, if you can't do that, what can you do?
Right.
Well, the legislature's statement, the mayor's statement is, well, we're going to build these resource centers. We're going to move people out of homelessness. We're not just going to move the homeless to a different neighborhood. We're going to make them not homeless. And but people aren't really ready to buy that. And of course, there are some of us who look at this and see the evil genius of Greg Hughes ruining Ben McAdams' future political career because he's the only Democrat that counts around here by hanging this all on him.
Well, we'll see if that plan. We should point out that he's a Draper Republican representative, and that I don't know if that has any kind of impact on the conversation about the state prison and development there. But of course, Draper invited that.
Invited it, and he said that he'd be open to whatever location that this Ben McAdams and the state committee. Because we should point out, Ben McAdams recommended a site.
Yeah.
By April 10th, the state committee has to ratify it. Now, when we've seen how politically sensitive this is, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that this state group is going to ratify it unless some massive problem comes up.
Guys, we have to take another quick break here on the program. Still to come, a conversation about an alt-right Mormon blogger. Maybe we'll stick with homelessness for a little bit longer. Also, a veto that Governor Gary Herbert enacted last week. Or signed, I guess, last week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. It's the Spring Pledge Drive, and thank you so much for your support. We've had an outpouring of support all through the drive. It continues today, the last day of the drive. And instead of counting up at this point, we're counting down. So to reach our overall goal for the entire drive, we're only $500 away. That's great news. Your pledge next to 800-826-1495 can help us to get there. 800-826-1495 is the number to call. Or you could go to upr.org. We're just $500 away, not from this hour's goal, but from the overall Spring Pledge Drive goal. And we hope that you will pledge your support. 800-826-1495.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Christopher Smart, George Pyle. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, before the break, we were talking about the shelter in the Rio Grande neighborhood. I actually want to just for a quick moment remind listeners about the news that's breaking, which is essentially that Ben McAdams, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams, has chosen or has recommended a site for the shelter that Salt Lake County is on the hook for building.
Yes, it's 3380 South 10th West. It's near the juvenile detention facility and the sheriff's office and the Salt Lake County Emergency Management Building. It is a vacant lot that right now is controlled by a nonprofit, so it's cheap. South Salt Lake is not thrilled with this, but they can't fight it under state law.
Well, is this a recommendation? What happens next in this process?
So now it goes to a state committee that has to ratify this decision by April 10th. This has been a very rapid process, as Chris pointed out, artificially so. There's no thing that's pushing this. But Ben McAdams said in his letter this morning that he does not want to see construction start here until other cities in the county pony up some money to help support the homeless shelters that, yes, they're based in Salt Lake and presumably South Salt Lake, but this is a state problem.
At the beginning of the state legislative session this year, that was something that Greg Hughes said. Speaker of the House Greg Hughes, he said that this is a statewide problem, not a Salt Lake City or Salt Lake County problem. And that was part of the sort of impetus that led to a kind of deal being struck on homelessness in our valley, I guess.
Right. And we should point out at this stage, there is no evidence that the legislature is backing away from the idea that this is a statewide statewide problem. The House Speaker has been very upfront and very involved. The legislature gave $20 million to this effort this year, which was more than they were asked to give this year. They put 2 years' worth of funding into 1 year. They've put their money behind this. They have said the right things. What Ben McAdams wants to see is that actually continue, where other cities help siphon some money to support this land.
Ongoing funding is part of the issue, especially for services that that people are kind of concerned about. Chris Smart?
Well, right now we don't know where the money is going to come from to provide all these services. The service at end of this thing is key. What Ben McAdams is doing here is somewhat unique, but it's going to depend on the services. What he's saying is we need 500 or 600 beds less, because we're not going to just warehouse these folks. We're going to bring them in, we're going to get them the services they need, and they are going to be off on their own, productive members of society again.
Some percentage of them are, at least.
But where's the money coming from? They don't know yet. I mean, we're talking tens of millions of dollars that have not been identified. It could be private. It could be public. We just don't know.
Okay. Because I want to turn kind of to a conversation. You know, we were talking about, I'm going to leave homelessness behind for now and move along. We were talking a little bit about the Pioneer Park Coalition and the work that they're doing in the Rio Grande neighborhood, or the, I guess, the opinion they have about what's happening in the Rio Grande neighborhood. And a member of that coalition, Matt Canham, is property developer Josh Romney. This is Mitt Romney's son. Just this week, his name was floated as a potential candidate for governor, though we should say who was doing the floating. It was kind of a partisan party in this concept.
His mom.
Yeah.
His mom was on national TV. It was asked about the future, political future of the family, and she said that she believes that a political run is in Josh Romney's future here in the state of Utah. He has some young children, and so the family's idea is you don't want to have to keep traveling between D.C. and Utah when you have a bunch of young children you want to raise. You want to keep them close, like the governor's mansion. So 2020, Governor Gary Herbert is not running for reelection, so that's a prime opportunity for multiple people to run. Jason Chaffetz is also made it very clear that that's a seat he's looking at. And the Chaffetz and Romney families have been close, so that would be a very interesting race. As someone who covers politics, I encourage both of them to run, because it would be a very good story to cover.
Some good story.
I would love two high-profile names within the Republican Party to face off. So everyone run.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, an endorsement.
Yes.
Josh Romney has flirted with runs for political office in the past. Lieutenant governor was something he looked at. Is that correct?
Yes. With Kirk Jowers, the former director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, was going to be the governor on this ticket. They went around. They tried to talk to donors. And at the end of the day, they decided not to challenge Herbert. And Josh Romney has also looked at congressional runs in other areas.
You know, he'd have his name going for him, the Romney name, but he doesn't have a lot in the way of political or government experience, though maybe that isn't as big of a requirement these days as it used to be.
Well, I guess it might not be that much of a requirement at all. Orrin Hatch was a lawyer. He became a senator. Mike Lee was a lawyer. Became a senator. They didn't hold any political office before. Chris Stewart ran a business, was an environmental consultant, and now is a member of Congress. Jason Chaffetz was the chief of staff of a governor, held no elected office as a member of Congress. So we have a long history of electing people who don't necessarily have political experience.
George Pyle, is that a good thing, or what is it?
Well, it's kind of too bad, because you would kind of think that maybe like the legislature would be where you'd groom future governors.
Right.
And we don't do that, partly because, I would guess, is because if you're in the legislature, you make a lot of enemies. Mm-hmm. You actually make decisions. You have a record that can be attacked. If you're coming from outside and you're in business or you're in law, you have contacts, you know people, you can raise money, and there is the kind of the on-the-job test of, can you run a campaign? And if you can run a campaign, well, maybe you can run a state. Similar skill sets. But at the same time, you know, just part of the reason we have the president we have today is because he wasn't a Bush and he wasn't a Clinton. And some of us were getting a little tired of these same names over and over again. And the question around here is, especially people who voted for Mitt Romney for president and wish he had become president, if they have another chance to vote for somebody named Romney, will all this other stuff...
They might have two chances.
Yes.
Mitt Romney took a run at Orrin Hatch's seat,
yes.
Josh Romney took a run at the governor's office, we might have Governor Romney and Senator Romney.
Yeah, and talk about a family business.
It seems dynasties are not anathema to American politics. Guys, we're running out of time, and I think we need to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. George Pyland, maybe I'll stick with you. Do you have an underplayed story you want to kick us off with?
Well, I think you started to mention, and I think I'll kind of connect the dots here. Yesterday's Salt Lake Tribune, on one page, this story about this alt-right Mormon blog,
right,
where she's going on and on about how the Mormon Church is committing suicide by bringing in brown people from around the world. On another page, a bunch of BYU law students go off to pro bono serve as lawyers for immigrants and refugees who are trying to get into the country. Mm. So here's you got your angel on one shoulder, you got your devil on the other, and that's just human nature.
All right, alt-right code for, white supremacy, Matt Canham.
Yes.
Matt Canham, your underplayed story of the week?
Yes, the Mormon Church reached out to Senator Orrin Hatch and asked for help, and he is now sponsoring a bill to make it easier to get missionaries into the United States. Apparently, the process now requires, if you want to sponsor a missionary from another country, you have to do an application for that person, but also for that religion. And so every single time they have to submit this documentation about what the Mormon Church is and why this is an organization that will support this person, and every time a different person looks at it and makes a judgment, and they come up with different judgments. So this bill would make it so that the government recognizes that the Mormon Church is an entity, that this is the same category every time, and that they just look at the individual. So this bill is now moving through Congress.
Would that apply across the board for all religions?
All religions, okay. But it involves religions that bring in 1,000 missionaries a year. I'm guessing that is an incredibly small group that might just be the Mormon Church. I don't know of another church that brings in
missionaries.
1,000 yep. missionaries from outside the United States every year.
Chris Smart, we need your underplayed story of the week, but kind of quickly here.
Very quickly, this morning in the Washington Post reported that Arby's has more employees than the entire coal industry in America.
Wow. That's a quick one-liner, Chris Smart, with a shocking fact. For mine, I'm going to go with Robert Gerke's column that he published yesterday. He takes the words of a famous fellow from a couple thousand years ago and updates them to... criticize the response by communities like Draper, South Salt Lake, West Valley City, Sugar House, etc., to shelter the homeless in their neighborhoods. It's a good read. Check it out at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, Chris Smart, George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much for being with us here on the show today.
Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis and Emily Means here at KCPW, to Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio. And thanks very much to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or however you get your podcasts. I'll quickly mention in the time remaining that you can find us on Facebook. We are at KCPW-FM, and at Twitter, we are at KCPW. We are also in our spring pledge drive here at the station, and we need your help. The number to call is 801-359-5279. You can also go to kcpw.org and help us make up some ground on our fundraising. We are a bit behind with one day left. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks very much for joining us on the program today, and have a great weekend.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cache Valley Center for the Arts, presenting the Hillbenders, Tommy, a Bluegrass Opry, a full-length bluegrass tribute featuring banjo, dobro, mandolin, bass, and guitar to the Who's Tommy, Tuesday, April 11th at 7:30 p.m. Details at cachearts.org.
Follow the musical migration from Scotland through Ulster and on down the Great Wagon Road into southern Appalachia. Chart a remarkable musical diaspora already fading in the collective memory this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Join us tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio. service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. This is Utah Public Radio. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCU Price, and KUSUFM Logan. Heard online at upr.org.